Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sarah Palin, maverick moose-hunting hockey mom, has been out on the national stage just 2 short weeks. But her presence, along with the strong presence of Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama this election season, has reignited a decades-old debate on gender and sexism in America. This hour, On Point, we'll talk with women about how they view the women of 2008. You can join our conversation. Are Sarah, Hillary, and Michelle the role models you're looking for? What do they tell us about where the women's movement stands today? Later this hour, we'll hear from James Haggerty of the Wall Street Journal about the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bailout. But right now, joining me from Seattle, Washington, is Sandra Singh Loh. She's a writer, a performer, and a frequent NPR commentator. And her new book is Mother on Fire. Sandra, great to have you with us.
Hey, Jane. Great to be here.
And joining us from New York City is Kay Heimowitz. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor for City Journal, and author of Marriage and Caste in America, Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age. Kay, thanks for joining us as well.
Hi, Jane.
So, Sandra, let me begin with you. What does the dominance of strong women in this presidential race say about where we are in politics today?
Well, as a Democratic woman, I'm so depressed. I've taken to my bed with a big ice pack on and a bunch of freedom fries, and I don't know where. I think when I was watching Sarah Palin's speech, I screamed to my husband, who didn't understand what I was talking about. I said, "The women's movement is over. How did we blow it? How did the Democrats blow it?" I felt severely depressed. And the reason that I feel, and I voted for Hillary in the primary just because I have two daughters. I gave her that bully cry, even though I'm not wildly in love with her. She's a little hard to love, but I voted for her. I think for me, it's not, and I've done a lot of writing, like in The Atlantic, about the mommy's wars and mm-hmm. women's issues and mm-hmm. gender, et cetera. And I think it's not so much gender. I think I feel that Sarah Palin was able to become, she was able to do that rebel yell, the woman's mom's rebel yell against Washington. I felt so depressed that the Republicans had taken that over. I think she was the one that said she's the PTA mom. And I also am a PTA mom. And I don't know how we Democrats have lost this moment of us being able to say that we are America, we're in our schools, we're in our public schools. And my depression went further when I write on a New York Times blog where another of my New York Times writers brought up the fact that all the candidates send their kids to private school except for Sarah Palin. I looked up her little elementary, Iditarod Elementary in Alaska, and on a grade school scale of 1 to 10, it's a 4. So she has a lot of street cred. I was very depressed.
Well, let's get depressed. Kay Heimowitz's take on this. Give us the other side. What's your reaction, and what do you think the dominance of all these women means in presidential politics today?
Well, I don't know whether I'm going to be giving another side. I do agree with Sandra that this is a transformative moment for feminism. Mm-hmm. Sarah Palin really represents a new cultural type. Despite, you know, forget about the politics for a minute. Just think about the cultural type that she represents, which I call the red feminist, red state feminist. And I think that what Sandra's leaving out here is that there was a problem at the core of feminism, second wave feminism, which is what Sarah Palin is exploiting. That's probably not the right word, but is transcending. And that problem was a deep ambivalence about marriage and motherhood. I'm old enough to remember the second waivers and the talk about from Betty Friedan about the housewife being a waste of human self, the comfortable concentration camp. That was the home that women were in. Then we had, Gloria Steinem's talk about fish and bicycles and that kind of thing. And I think there were a large number of American women who were very reluctant to sign on to that brand of what I'll call blue state feminism as a kind of shorthand. And what we're seeing now is the emergence of a very new type.
Mm. So, Kay, give us the profile of a voter who's going to show up and vote for John McCain, Sarah Palin, for that ticket because of Sarah Palin.
Well, I can give you that. I'll try to give you that portrait, but with the proviso saying that I don't find it very appealing. I understand it, but I think that the whole idea of voting for a woman because she's a mother or because she's a woman doesn't make any sense to me. But at any rate, the portrait is this: women who feel that their identities are deeply, deeply entwined in their marriages, their families, their motherhood, who are put off by the kind of what they view as a kind of elitism of the blue state feminists, rough edges, but the anger that they often sense in the blue staters. You know, one of the
I think Sarah Palin, she's angry, she's irate.
That's true. That's true. That's fair. That she. I don't know if she's irate, but she certainly has a lot of resentment towards.
But I think that. But I think that's what she. That's her rebel yell. That's her howl, for better or worse.
Well, and Sandra,
What it is.
What about going from the PTA to the vice presidency? I mean, is that a story that many women can relate to? You know,
I'm the
supermarket. Is that part of?
I'm really afraid to say that it is. I'm like that. And from PTA, and here I am standing up for the PTA, and I find, you know, with Kay, again, for me and Kay to agree, well, Kay, you know, perhaps so, but I think it certainly
you don't
in
know
the writings
me,
of feminism, that the PTA, and I think that you know, we're right, feminism has gone through recently a very adolescent stage, our bodies, ourselves, our navels, ourselves, my angst, my body angst, my angst about my body angst, blah, blah, blah. It's been entirely a navel-gazing situation. I think any serious study of feminism should look at the PTA. It's a 100-plus-year-old organization, was started by the Congress of Mothers. They do amazing stuff on a local level. They bake their way. And I know at our school, you know, we bake our way 50 cents at a time to after-school programs, music and enrichment programs. And in California, the PTA has the power to push through legislation, particularly recently in the K-2, you know, K-3 limiting our class size to 20. So it's a hugely powerful organization. It is amazing, and it's old guard women, you know, the bouffant hair and different colored pins and different color. I'm saying the Pledge of Allegiance. So culturally, that might be a turnoff to some of the hipsters of my generation. But when you see power of those licenses and the tax exemption, you go, man, these ladies rock. There's a lot of power
and
here,
yet,
and we ignore it at our peril.
Okay, exactly. Is that a segment of America that to date has been overlooked?
Oh, absolutely. Well, at least by certain segments of the political class, absolutely. And it seems to me that no one should have been surprised by the emergence of somebody like Sarah Palin. There are young evangelicals who are quite different than the old guard. They take for granted that women will be in the workplace. They in many cases have the sorts of egalitarian marriages that Sarah Palin appears to have. And by the way, I think that's sort of interesting that we haven't made that much of that issue, because that is such a dominant theme in the feminist literature right now. That is the preference for an egalitarian marriage. Well, here we see one, as near as we can tell. We'll probably learn more about it. And it's coming from the wrong side.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation now before we take our first break. In Albany, New York, is Deborah Dickerson. She's a contributing writer for Mother Jones and the author of The End of Blackness, Returning the Souls of Black Folk to Their Rightful Owners. Deborah, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
I'm curious what you think Sarah Palin means to women at this point, and compare that with what Hillary Clinton means to women in this country today.
It's interesting, and you guys are going to have to bear with me because I'm coming late to the party here, so I don't know what's been said already, but I'm sure my brilliance will make it all new. I think there's just so much there. It's hard to know where to jump in. When the dust settles, whenever that is, maybe when my 5-year-old daughter is 25, I think what hopefully we will come from this is a sort of convergence. I think that whatever the reasons for nominating, for choosing Sarah Palin, and I've got a squint eye about the reasons for having chosen her, I think that what's going to happen, what I hope that what's going to happen is that, you know, to be simplistic, right-wingers and left-wingers will start to say, it is significant to have a woman nominated for vice president of whatever party. And people who have not previously been saying, vote for me because I'm a woman, or that there is real sexism. For instance, the argument that Hillary Clinton encountered real sexism. I think that what I consider to be a fairly cynical nomination will help get to a place where both sides can kind of converge and actually give credence to the other person's point of view. That this whole subject is so complicated and hard to talk about. I'm fumbling for words here, but I think the reason she was chosen are pretty cynical. But I think it's going to be a good thing. And liberal women and conservative women and people who care about these issues, which should be everybody, will start to say, okay, you know, all right, we're not going to talk about this woman's daughter, even though it's typically the people from the right, we liberals think, and I'm too tired to pretend not to be a liberal. I think there's going to be some convergence there.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about gender and politics and what women like Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton mean for America. Sandra Singh Lowe is with us. She's a writer, a performer, and a frequent NPR commentator. Also with us is Deborah Dickerson. She's a contributing writer for Mother Jones. And Kay Heimowitz is with us as well. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor for City Journal. I'd like to hear some sound now from Sarah Palin. This is in her acceptance speech last week, where she said she has served her state of Alaska with a, quote, servant's heart. She said part of serving the common good involved working against entrenched interests.
This was the spirit that brought me to the governor's office when I took on the old politics as usual in Juneau, when I stood up to the special interests and the lobbyists and the big oil companies and the good old boys. Suddenly, I realized that sudden and relentless reform never sits well with entrenched interests and power brokers.
So, Kay Heimowitz, let's talk about the issues here. Governor Palin's strong on energy. She matches McCain's image as a reformer. Have we heard enough about all of that?
Oh, not at all. No, I think there's an awful lot more reporting that we need to see. This is also new, and I actually am still finding that day after day there are clarifications and modifications to each side's assertions about Sarah Palin. So I think it's kind of early to make too many generalizations about it. But I do want to comment on that servant's heart line, which I find kind of interesting, where she said, I came to serve with a servant's heart. I think that the other thing that red state feminists find appealing about Sarah Palin is that she doesn't seem to be ambitious for herself. I mean, I think that one of their hesitations about Hillary Clinton was that they viewed her as having a kind of grasping ambition. Sarah Palin set herself up as something in a different mode. She describes herself, and we can analyze whether this is the case or not. Describes herself as somebody who is just trying to make things better. You know, working through the grassroots of the PTA, as Sandra was talking about, and then you know, trying to improve life for her kids, for her neighbors, and her fellow Alaskans, and that kind of thing. It has a different feeling to the red state feminists, I think, than the kind of ambition that they see in a lot of blue state feminists.
Oh, no, it's not a blue. We blue staters have a servant's heart. We are out there. We educated women. We're rebuilding our parks and playgrounds and in our public schools. Okay, I admit maybe we haven't seen many of us in the media, but we are out there and we have to make our case better.
Yeah,
and
no,
trashing Barack Obama as a community activist. How can you say a community organizer? How can you embrace her servant's heart description of herself and then at the same time denigrate Barack Obama for being a community organizer? So
Okay, huge enemies, particularly in my household where my husband, who's a Democrat, is going to kill me and I'm a Democrat. I wish, and I'm going to get killed, but it's Monday. I'll start quickly. I wish Barack and Michelle would put their kids in public school in Chicago. I wish that. I think it would be amazing. And also, you know, and Joe Biden and McCain's, although those would be the people I'd really love to see in public school.
Okay, go ahead and make your
point. It would be amazing for a public school, for a local public school, for a family of public schools, if the professional, political, media, journalism class who've all left public schools in this country would get their kids back in the game, back in the pool, have
a
dog
really
in the fight like the rest of us.
My two kids both go to a public charter school. And yeah,
your presence there
point.
Is amazing. Your presence there is amazing.
Let me get
and
it was, it ladies, I want to get back to the issue at hand, which is
oh,
women
it,
in this race. Stay with me here, please. Historically, Americans have voted for the top of the ticket, regardless of who the vice presidential pick is. With Sarah Palin, does that template still hold, or are we in a new territory here altogether? Deborah Deckerson, you start.
That is the question. Is this woman a pair? Is this person? I didn't mean that to come out the way that sounded. Is she prepared to be the president? I mean, is she? I like to think I'm not being blinded by my liberal bias here, but what qualifies her to be, as they say, a chicken bone away from the Oval Office and the football? What qualifies her for that? This is an enormous gamble that the country's going to have to take.
But that's not the question. The question is, does the template still hold here, regardless of what's happened in the past with Americans voting for the top of the ticket? Will Sarah Palin make a difference to elevate John McCain to victory? Kay, what do you think?
Well, I want to just step back for a second and try to defend myself. My description before of Red State Feminist View was not my own. It was not to say that I totally agree with them, by the way. You know, it was simply to describe what I think is out there and to try to see it from their point of view. I actually don't believe that Sarah Palin's going to really transform this election. As I said before, I think she's a transformative figure, but culturally, not politically. Because the fact is we are facing such extremely difficult questions about, our foreign policy and our economic policy and so on and so forth. And I don't think that in the end people are going to be thinking that much about the vice presidency. I also think that I hope that people will have a more sophisticated approach to their decision making than to just say, well, she's like me and therefore I'm going to vote for her. But I think that is a problem that can partly be blamed on feminism because feminists, after all, have put so much emphasis on voting for women and trying to achieve, trying to find women in public office.
I don't think that's fair.
Go ahead, Sandra.
And I just want to add to that so many things to think about. But I think, again, Kay, unfortunately, I have to agree with her on where feminism has gone a bit wrong. Kay, we'll lunch together at some point, secretly. and I think that it's interesting when you read feminist women's issues discussions that people like Condoleezza Rice are never brought up. You know, when they talk about powerful women, Condoleezza Rice is not brought up, but Ann Richards were always quoting with her wacky sayings in Texas, who is delightful, but she lost her last election. You know, it's like Condoleezza. And also Ann Coulter is another person that is never brought up, of course, because, well, I happen to think she's a scary monster, but she's also a woman. You know, so that I think that for women's studies and feminists to pick and choose which ones we want on our team, it's true. I mean, they're all women. And to go back to your issue of the template, Jane, I feel very badly that we're, you know, evading your questions, but no, I think it's everything's blown sky high this election, and I think everything's blown sky high. So I think everything will change in some way this particular election. It's record
breaking. Let me put in some sound here from Hillary Clinton, because here she is in a speech on December 26th at the Democratic National Convention, where she noted how far women have come in a single generation.
After so many decades, 88 years ago on this very day, the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote, became enshrined in our Constitution. My mother was born before women could vote. My daughter got to vote for her mother for president. This is the story of America, of women and men who defy the odds and never give up.
Deborah Dickerson, do you think we've overcome the issue in this country of whether a woman can actually lead?
Oh, of course not. We're getting there. We're getting there in fits and starts. We're further along now with this discussion that we've had to go through, this experience. We're farther along than we have been, but we're never going to get over it until somehow a woman actually does manage to become president. And I think that we're not there, but we're going to get there. I think we get closer and closer all the time. But I really have to say, I really get very frustrated with these unfair digs that I think feminism takes. There's this broad brush, and I think that people who criticize feminism, and in there I will lump conservatives and Republicans, you know, they pick and choose. You know, you use the language of feminism when it suits you, which is what Sarah Palin is doing. But then at the same time, you stand back and say, well, feminism has done this and done that, and this adolescent phase and that kind of thing. You know, I think the criticisms of feminism are unwarranted. And if Condoleezza Rice is left out of the conversation, okay, bring her in. You know, group puts itself forward. There has to be a speech. I'm somebody who does this all the time as a black person. I've made this point all the time. Why do you defend the Rutgers women basketball team, but you don't defend Condoleezza Rice when horrible things are said about her? So I'm in that community. And when the conversation is lacking, provide it. So there has to be speech and you can't just, there's not this unified voice of feminism. If something's left out, put it in.
Panel, let me jump in here, because I want to get some callers into our conversation. You've all had a nice shot here. Let's give our listeners a
hit.
And
I came in late. I need more time.
Yes, you did. That is
Everyone
fair.
Always
that is
needs fair. More time. Elaine is on the line from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Elaine. Welcome to the program.
How are you?
Hi, good. Welcome.
I just wanted to say that regardless of party, I think one of the things that candidates like Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin need to do is they need to address the issues that women are facing. You know, we need safe child care for children, quality public schools, equal pay, and hopefully them being in the forefront will start those issues going. I know that they've been discussed for years, but there are women out there that are having to make tough decisions nowadays. You know, we're a big part of the workforce, yet we're struggling to try to do it all, and these women need to make these issues loud and clear. They need to bring them to the forefront. Otherwise, their candidacies aren't going to mean anything to us.
Elaine, thank you.
You're
it's a good
man.
Point.
Well
is the prevalence of women in this race going to change how generally we view women as far as women's issues, child care, health care, and on, as the caller just brought up? Elaine? Kay, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that a Sarah Palin sort of nominee is going to address the child care issue in quite the way the caller has in mind, because there is a fundamental ideological disagreement about government's role in child care, and that I don't think is going to go away just because she's a woman. She obviously is not relying on government child care and doesn't believe in it, and so I don't think that'll change. The school issue is something that Republicans, I don't know about how much Sarah Palin has been involved in this debate at all, but that Republicans have actually been talking about quite a bit, and conservatives, my think tank, for instance, has been heavily involved in the school reform for many, many years. So, and that's, we don't see that as a woman's issue. We see that as also a labor market issue. We see that as an American competitiveness issue, and so on and so forth.
Who wanted to jump in? Was that you, Sandra?
Yes, me, as usual. I think Elaine's point was amazing. I think that many ordinary women go through the day far away from the chattering classes, and their day looks very different than the professional pundit class. And I think what she's talking about, child care, if you look at public school, after-school programs, it's like these things have to be built from the ground up. And there's so many, you know, with the – now I can say I'm against the – there's so much think tankery and punditry about the market issues and things driving things. It's all dollars and cents, but in fact, in public education and child care, many of these issues are interesting barter issues. They're microeconomies that often don't draw the attention of the, you know, of the more important economists. It's really interesting the way trust is built in communities. And I think these are things that go beyond dollars and cents. And many ordinary women face these things every single day. After school programs, child care, all that kind of stuff. And I think that it's important that women take it somehow on a day-by-day basis. So I think the caller's point was absolutely right. Most women face issues that sound very different than the talking class's issues.
What about the other two women in this race we haven't talked about? Michelle Obama, Cindy McCain. Let's start with Michelle Obama. How has gender and race played into her experience on the national stage so far? Kay, will you start?
Well, I think Michelle Obama has obviously tried to change her image in order to be a first lady, to play the first lady role. I mean, this is just the way politics works in this country, for better or worse. And I think she's done a very, very effective job at it. She is not just somebody who pronounces her love for her children and her husband, but does so in a way that still sounds very modern and looks very contemporary. She is tough and clearly her husband's equal. So insofar as this game is still being played, I think she plays it very well.
What about Cindy McCain? Sandra?
Well,
I don't know why that's funny.
The first few things that jumped to mind, I thought, you know, you shouldn't say that on public radio. What can be said about Cindy McCain? But she held Sarah Palin's baby without dropping the baby at the Republican convention. That's all I can say. I'm sorry, I really can't say anything that is not going to get me into more trouble.
Deborah, what do you think?
I love the way, they run their Anheuser-Busch military complex down their corporate complex. What can I say?
Deborah Dickerson, like jump in. Go ahead.
She's sort of the new Nancy Reagan, you know? The beautiful look, the millions of dollars, this whole sort of thing that it's interesting, this whole maverick thing. But I really think that she appeals to that Nancy Reagan aristocratic, that Ron and Nancy kind of thing. I mean, she's classically beautiful. She dresses extremely, you know, the gold outfit at the convention. Wow. And the millions. I think that there are going to that. I don't know. I think that's the working class thing that everybody's trying to do, and that Sarah Palin and Joe Biden are definitely going to do in their debates and stuff. But on the side, you've still got this in the 80s, people found that Nancy and Ron aristocratic thing so appealing, and I found it really made me very, very angry when times were so tough. That and here again, times are extremely tough 26 years later, but she's off to the side. So I think that there is a segment of society, male and female, who will very much like what she brings to the table. But I think they're wise to keep her as much on the periphery as possible. But it does give them a touch of Cary Grant 1940s, if that appeals to you. But if she stays on the periphery, it probably won't hurt him very much.
This This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about prominent women in this political season, and you can join our conversation. Sandra Singh Lowe is with us. She's a frequent NPR commentator. Deborah Dickerson is a contributor to Mother Jones. And Kay Heimowitz is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Let's go right to the phones now. Several callers lined up here. Let's get you in. Brenda is on first from Jackson, South Carolina. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Sarah Palin has set women back 40, 50 years. We are right back to the myth of superwoman, that if a woman is going to have a career, especially a high-profile career, she had better do it all and do it all well. And nobody can do it all, not women, not men. But the difference is we don't require men to do it all. We just require that they set a priority and do that one thing well. But if a woman is going to have a family and a career, then we require her to be expert and competent at all of it. And Sarah Palin is playing to that myth, and people are just eating it up. And all the rest of us are going to suffer by comparison.
Mm. All right, Brenda, thank you. Kay Heimowitz, will you respond to the caller?
Sure. I would take issue with the caller only in this way. Remember that this does appear to be an egalitarian marriage between Sarah and Todd. I'm under the impression that should she become vice president, he will be quitting his work and moving into the, what is that building down there called that houses the vice president? However, I think there is something to the caller's complaint about the superwoman idea. I mean, the person that Sarah Palin most reminded me of was a superhero. You remember the character in The Incredibles, Elastigirl? Mm-hmm. You know, she can do everything because mm-hmm. She's got hands that can go from here to there and legs and take care of her family and save her husband and on and on and on. I think there is a problem. By the way, she also, Elastigirl named her first son Dash, and you may remember that Sarah Palin calls her first son Track, which I found sort of a funny parallel. But at any rate, I think there is something to that. And I also will add a kind of provocative statement here to that. I think that it's legitimate to ask under these circumstances how exactly she's going to manage with the five children and the Down syndrome child and so on and so forth. That strikes me as a question that should not be off limits.
Can I jump in here?
This go ahead, gets Sandra. Me.
No, this is Deborah.
Oh, hi, Deborah. Go ahead.
Hi. The earlier point I was making about convergence that I made so ineloquently, this gets me back to the point. It's so interesting to me. And again, I'm the token hairy leg paleo feminist on the panel. So let me, in a banner I wear proudly, if exhaustedly. It's interesting because, the red state, blue state, very oversimplified dichotomy. It's the red, and sometimes I get the colors mixed up, but it's the red states who, then the conservatives who criticize women who work, especially when they have lots of kids. And here we are in this situation where it's the red state person who's doing that. And this is, I'm always the counterintuitive one, but I wonder if it's going to bring alive for conservatives who say, women should put family first, and liberals who say, let women make their own decisions, because now liberals are going to have a really hard time making the same kind of criticisms that they reject when aimed in the other direction. But I wonder if it's going to make conservatives, and I'm using that very, very, sloppily, say, maybe we really should. I can see it when it's Sarah Palin. Maybe I need to consider when it's a political opponent that I should mind my own business and let this person make her family decisions. And a liberal will say, if the woman, I want to criticize her because it's politically expedient, but my philosophy has always been women make their own choices. So maybe what there can be some weird kind of counterintuitive convergence as people are forced to examine their public statements and their souls and say, okay, maybe.
Interesting.
Can I just jump in there for
quickly, and then we're going to go to the phones again.
That convergence already happened quite a while ago. You know, evangelical women, if you look at the polls, and there's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal on Friday about this. If you look at polls, evangelical women, and men for that matter, are quite in supportive, particularly younger ones, quite supportive of women in the workplace. And I think that the image of the biblical woman staying at home and just doing prayers with her children is just not, it doesn't hold up to reality, and certainly not to the polls.
Let's go to the phones now. Mark is in Moline, Illinois. Hi, Mark. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for calling.
First time I called in, and I was raised in union home, and I happen to be a conservative Christian, just listening to you guys talk. And, you know, you grow up with the jokes of, hey, if there's ever a woman as a president or vice president of power position, there'd be a war every 20-some days. And, you know, when you grow up with that, it's kind of funny at the time, but as you grow older and you go, how chauvinistic that is. And, you know, and I watched her the other day, and I was just blown away by her. And just thought...
You liked her.
What an opportunity for our country. You know, someone that with tenacity and fire, but great intelligence and great accomplishment that stood up and went after things that weren't right and wrong. And you know, I'm sure there's some that she's blown a little smoke on, like every politician, but a working husband that stays with her kids some. And, you know, I think it's a great opportunity for our country. I think it does, as one of your guests there was saying, challenge the liberal side to say, hey, are we really going to support what we say, or are we going to come against her because of her children now? And it challenged the conservative side to say, hey, you know, can she do this? You know, that's her challenge. It's her children. And can her husband support her in it for this season of time? And can he do an excellent job with the children?
Mark, thanks for your call and your perspective. I appreciate it. Let's get one more call in here now from Tallahassee, Florida. Betty is on the line. Hi, Betty. Welcome.
Yes, I was just listening to you all, and I had one of the ladies there when you asked them about how Michelle Obama is changing herself or adapting to, you know, how she's doing, and mm-hmm. she said how, you know, she was just talking how well Michelle is doing, and then you asked her something about Cindy, and then she just laughed. She didn't have anything to say about Michelle and about Cindy McCain. And she, you know, it's like you're trying to portray like Cindy McCain doesn't really bring anything, or she's not. You know, the fact that she has a lot of money does not mean that Michelle is any different. Why do you think Michelle is doing better than Cindy? Why? What does the money have to do with you know, Miss Cindy's money is her money. It's not, you know, she doesn't have anything to do with. Does that have affect her from, you know, prevent her from being a first lady?
Betty, thanks.
You know, just to jump in here, well, I sort of agree with the caller. Again, being such a sad Democrat, it's like they're all of a certain class at a certain point, and well, there you go. So I sort of agree with the caller, sadly. Again, gloomy.
I'd like to finish up with our panel here by asking each of you, as a woman, watching the women in this race, this presidential year, what do you specifically, I guess let's focus on Sarah Palin as we go out here. What do you fear for her, and what do you hope for her as a woman moving forward? Deborah Dickinson, will you start quickly for each one of you, please?
I fear that their ticket will win. But if their ticket wins, and I fear that McCain will die and she will fall on her face as the first woman president, because I truly believe she is absolutely a pig in a poke. So my fear for her is that she'll get the job and really, really mess it up.
Kay Heimowitz?
Well, I actually share Deborah's fear. I think that she is unqualified. I think we have no reason to think that she's ready to be president. I probably like her temperament and her persona better than Deborah does, but I would agree with her about the dangers of a Palin presidency.
Sandra Singlo finishes up here.
Okay, I'm going to say, you go girl, Sarah Palin. I don't understand you, but you go girl. Please take on the NRA. The NRA is a nightmare. We have controls on toys, on Advil, on cars. You have to wear seatbelts. There's no safety stuff on the children can pick them up every year and blow their heads off every single year. Please, if you're really a maverick, you will get there and take on your own NRA. And then I'll say, you go, girl.
Ladies, thank you for your insights this hour. Sandra Singh Lowe, writer, performer, NPR commentator, whose new book is Mother on Fire. Sandra, thanks so much. Deborah Dickerson, contributing writer for Mother Jones. Thanks to you, Deborah.
Thanks for having me.
And Kay Heimowitz, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks to you, Kay, for your perspectives.
Thanks, Jane.
In a moment, the government takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This is On Point. Everyone feared it might come to this. This weekend it happened, a federal government takeover of mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Joining us now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is James Haggerty. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. James, nice to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Hello, thank you.
So tell us, what was it that triggered Henry Paulson to act now?
Well, that's still a bit of a mystery, but it seems that he and others concluded that sooner or later, the government was going to have to step in and rescue these companies. And so it would be better to do it now rather than let things get worse. And if he was going to step in with more cash to keep them going, he wanted to have control of the companies rather than letting them run their own affairs.
So a crisis was definitely coming?
Well, I think nobody can say exactly what was going to happen because it depends a lot on how much worse the economy gets, how much worse the housing market gets. But I think there was a very strong chance that these companies were going to run out of capital. They were not able to raise more money on their own because investors were too scared about pouring more money down that hole. Mm. And the U.S. government has decided that we can't live without Fannie and Freddie. We need them to provide funding for mortgages. As imperfect as the system is, you don't really want to change horses in the middle of a crisis like this.
Well, so what would have happened if Fannie and Freddie had failed? Because many said the government should not step in here.
Well, nobody knows what would have happened. I think there would certainly be a panic. Initially, we would have a lot of central banks around the world very angry at us if we weren't paying the obligations of Fannie and Freddie, because for many years, all of these foreign investors, including central banks, places like China, Japan, et cetera, have assumed that Uncle Sam stands behind these companies, even though technically the government did not have to stand behind them. But, you know, we rely on all this foreign capital to pay for our spendthrift ways in America, to buy all those treasury bonds. And I guess we have to keep the foreign investors happy.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, James.
Our housing market.
How are international markets, particularly China, responding to this news? Because China holds a lot of debt in Fannie and Freddie.
I think the initial reaction has been some relief, probably still some puzzlement over what this is all going to mean in the long run.
And what about Wall Street's reaction? You know, the federal government's bailed out Bear Stearns. Now it's bailing out Fannie and Freddie. What message are we sending Wall Street?
Well, the stock prices of Fannie and Freddie have really collapsed today to only a dollar or two a share. So the equity investors in these companies have been severely punished. The CEOs are being pushed out, although they'll have plenty of money to live on for the rest of their lives, I think. I think the message that has been reinforced is that the people who have bought bonds from Fannie and Freddie will be protected because the government feels we need these companies to keep functioning, particularly at a time when the housing market is very weak and we can't afford to lose this source of money for home mortgages.
What does the bailout mean, James Haggerty, for taxpayers?
For taxpayers?
Yes.
I think it means that, as we already really knew, they may be liable for a lot of the cost of cleaning up this mortgage mess. This makes it even more explicit that the government is going to have to step in and pay for some of the losses. Now, in the long run, it's possible that the taxpayers will be fine. The the Treasury may do all right on this investment because they are first in line to get dividends once Fannie and Freddie do return to health, which they probably will within a few years. They're going to get dividends on this preferred stock they're acquiring. They've got 80% of the equity in Fannie and Freddie now. They're going to be buying mortgage securities, and they will hope that in the long run those will pay off. But there is always a chance that they will lose a considerable amount. It could be, you know, $20, $30, $40, $50 billion. Nobody really knows for sure.
Can you put a price tag on the total bailout?
Well, yeah, for Fannie and Freddie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's really, you would just be guessing. The Treasury yesterday said that they stand ready to invest up to $100 billion in each company. They also said they don't think that will be necessary. They said they're, you know, throwing out this large sum just to reassure people that there's plenty of money available. I would say, you know, most people have been making guesses about the ultimate cost, have been talking in the range of $20, $30, $50 billion. But they really are guesses. It depends on what's going to happen to home prices and what's going to happen to the unemployment rate, because when people lose their jobs, that's when they are much more likely to default on their mortgages. It depends on a lot of things that we really can't predict.
And very quickly, as we wrap up here, James Haggerty, will Fannie and Freddie remain sort of quasi-governmental agencies at this point? What's the next step?
That's a very good question. They will, for the indefinite future, be under the control of their regulator, but they will still be owned by other shareholders as well. Ultimately, Congress is going to have to decide what to do with them. Once they're nursed back to health, Congress will have to decide in what form these companies will be relaunched, if any.
James Haggerty, I have to let that be the last word. I appreciate your time so much, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, giving us the up-to-date on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.